And Lionel Fanthorpe, our guest, next hour will open up the phone lines. But for now, his stories on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Lionel Fanthorpe, our very special guest. We're going to talk with him about some various stories. Of course, I may throw a few curveballs at you, Lionel, but I think you'll remember most of these.
I'll do my best.
You've only written over 250 books. The Green Children of Woolpit in England.
Oh, that's one of my favorite stories. Woolpit, as you know, for any of our listener friends who are having a chance of a vacation in England, it's very well worth going to visit this little village down in Suffolk, which is on the east coast, part of the area called East Anglia, where I came from. You know, this is the one where the Vikings had a whole load of influence, as we were saying earlier. But in the village of Woolpit, and the name either comes from the wool from sheep or from wolf, because in those days there were still wild wolves in the area, and the villagers would occasionally dig pit traps to protect themselves from it. So nobody's quite sure whether the village name just refers to the fabric wool or to the animal wolf. And some harvesters working in the field, this was during the reign of King Stephen, who, unfortunately for him, spent most of that reign in long and indecisive battles with a rival claimant for the throne, who was the Empress Matilda. And they both had different dynastic links and probably equally good claims, but it meant that the Civil War was disturbing the country as a whole, and so people were tense and anxious. And as we have noticed with the UFO phenomena, when there is tension and anxiety in society, there tend to be more reports of strange sightings and happenings. Now, this village of Woolpit, as we said, during the reign of old King Stephen, the harvesters working in the fields suddenly looked across from their very heavy work, all done by hand, of course, in those days, and they saw a boy and a girl emerging from the end of a ditch round the side of the field. And the boy and girl were dressed in green, and their skin was also green. Well, the villagers, who were good-hearted folks and who probably wanted the excuse to put down the scythe and the sickle for a few minutes and go and talk to somebody, gathered round the children and tried to see if they could help them. What did they want? The children at first had a lot of language difficulty. They finally indicated by signs that they were hungry, and the villagers provided food. All that they would eat were green vegetables, and what they seemed to like most were green beans. Anyhow, time passed, and the girl slowly lost her green coloring and began to look just like the other villagers. The boy, who I suspect was less constitutionally strong than his sister, died shortly after they were rescued. The girl grew up perfectly normally and, having lost the green color, as we said, married a man from King's Lynn. And one of my secret family smiles is that one of my grandfathers came from King's Lynn, and I wondered whether he was a descendant of this mysterious green lady who turned up in the village of Woolpit in Suffolk. The explanation that some have suggested is that they might have been kids who were exploited and forced to work in a copper mine, just as in the olden days some children were exploited and forced to sweep chimneys. And if you've got a child employee, if you are a copper miner, then that little boy or girl can get into a narrow seam vein of copper which an adult couldn't. So there were children who were exploited in that way. And as we know, it is likely that if you're in an atmosphere all the time that's rich in copper, and you're breathing the copper dust in as you cut it, maybe this could have accounted for some at least of that green coloring. Other explanations would suggest that they were from another dimension, or that they were again, from maybe they were extraterrestrials. It's just impossible to say how, at this distance in time, they got it. But the story is very well authenticated, and it's written up by a famous religious chronicler, a guy called Ralph of Coggeshall, who historians regard as being sensible and reliable. And in his actual retelling of the story, Ralph says, "I included this, strange as it is, because the evidence for it and the persistence of it in the village was so strong that there had to be an element of truth in it somewhere." So the Green Children of Woolpit, never properly explained, few theories, I mean, about the copper mining, but did they come from another dimension? Did they come from another planet? Were they brought here for some strange reason to test out, perhaps? You know, when we think about advanced civilizations in other worlds, one of the things they may be trying to help us with is our morality and our ethics. And it's possible that these children were some sort of, yet another theory, some sort of ethical test to see how the villagers would react to something so very different. And they passed the test because they treated the kids with great kindness and did their best for them.
I was thumbing on cable yesterday before the program, Lionel, and I came across the old movie, The Crucible.
Yes.
And my gosh, what happened in Salem, Massachusetts at that time, everybody who did anything out of the ordinary was accused of being a witch, and they would hang you.
This is absolutely terrifying when you think of the ways in which certain fundamentalist, shall we say, absolutely unbreakably hard, fixed views, whether they are religious or political or whether they are social. Once somebody had got hold of the idea that witchcraft existed, then it infected the minds of the people like a virus can infect the body. And this craze, this moral panic about witchcraft, witchcraft, witchcraft. And for the slightest offense, as you said yourself, don't dare to be different because you'll be dragged away as a heretic or a witch or a wizard or a soothsayer and dealt with brutally. What is it in the human mind that makes people behave in that way? I think the word I'm looking around for here is inflexibility. Now, nearly all the friends that you and I have who are interested in the paranormal and the anomalous and the strange and the weird and the eerie, we're open-minded, we're flexible. We can look at 10 or 20 different theories without wanting to light a bonfire for anybody who disagrees with us. And I don't know what it is that locks a human mind onto that one single track. And it's a bit like an express locomotive going down a track. If there's something in the way, then heaven help everybody on board. And I think one of the services, very seriously, that programs like yours can render, that Coast to Coast Mysteries can help with, is to open people's minds to say, "No, hang on a minute, there's another possibility. And if these people at Salem do have strange abilities, let's listen to them, let's question them, let's ask them, but don't let's condemn them."
And let's hang them, you know?
Yeah. You see, I think that a lot of it is, you know, in the minds of the inflexible people who want to hang them and get them out of the way because they're daring to challenge the accepted ideology, is because they're terrified. It's fear, a deep subconscious fear that leads to that irrational behavior. The people who are responsible for the mock trials and the hangings, and people like Matthew Hopkins in our country, who called himself the Witch Finder General and simply went around torturing innocent people until they screamed and confessed. And there's, "Oh, burn him, I knew I was right. She's a witch, he's a wizard. Let's get him dead." Now, the thing underneath it, I feel, is a fear of the unknown, whereas our listeners who love the mysteries, they want to investigate the unknown, because this is the cutting edge of progress and of human development and of new knowledge. But if something comes up which challenges your mental security, if you say, I believe A, B, and C, and somebody comes along and says, hey man, what about D? And you say, that's not in my list, burn him. And it's because of the fear that their own security is going to be threatened by a new theory, and they can't move with the time and pick up the new theory and incorporate it. I would guess that those of us who like unsolved mysteries could call ourselves incorporationists. If we can't solve it, we take it on board, and we'll discuss it, think about it, investigate it, research it, until we can solve it. But the other guy says, hey, I hate this thing. It's dangerous. It's evil. Let's get rid of it. And I would say philosophically and sociologically, I think that's the reason behind the Salem trials.
Did that ever happen in England at the same time?
Oh, yes, very, very much so. We had, in the county of Essex alone, I was doing some research statistics on this for one of my consultancy clients. In the county of Essex alone, over 600 people were executed as witches over a course of a century or two. And all the trial records still exist, so it was a terrible thing here. And because one of the prime movers of all this is, it was this guy Matthew Hopkins, who set himself up as the witch finder general, and with no qualifications other than those he'd given himself, he went around accusing people and went from village to village. And of course, the whole problem then was that if two neighbors didn't like each other and there was a dispute over a farm boundary fence, one of them could go up to Hopkins and say, my neighbor is a witch. She goes off into the woods at midnight and dances. Nothing at all. The poor woman goes to bed and sleeps at night. But once that suspicion has been laid against her, the guy solves his boundary dispute by getting rid of the neighbor, who is probably legally in the right.
Let's talk a little bit about the Wroxham Broad phenomenon, as about time slips.
Yeah, oh, indeed. Just before we go on to that one, George, can I give you one that came to me, another time slip phenomenon that came to me from a lovely lady called Tony Keyes from New York, and as a result of listening to us a way back, she sent me this email and gave me permission to tell her story, which is a lovely one. And these are her own words. I was in my office after hours, with my India ink, my pen, and a letter. I commenced writing the letter. I've never studied calligraphy, but I literally got scared because it felt as if I wasn't doing the writing. I stopped and I looked up, and I was in a stone room at a wooden table. My clothing was a long-robed affair with long sleeves and a hood, and many what seemed to be parchment documents were beside me. My pen was a quill, and the ink container was a pot, and my light was a soul candle, and it was very cold. I closed my eyes and said a prayer, and when I opened my eyes, I was back in my office. The episode is not one that I enjoy remembering, because somewhere along the line of incarnations, I think I lived like that, and it was not a happy existence, and I got the feeling in that time slip that I might not be able to come back. And, of course, when we go over to the Wroxham Broad time slips, those are absolutely astonishing.
Classics. It's a classic story.
Yeah. Now, they begin with, it goes right back to the 1600s, when two friends were swimming together across Wroxham Broad. And in their own words, the water, which they knew to be about 14 feet deep, seemed to go. And they found themselves on dry land, not only on dry land, but wearing Roman uniforms, and part of a huge Roman procession. And if I just read a few words of how this was in the archives of the Norfolk, which is Norfolk, for 1603. And this is what Ben Curtis wrote. In the great broad of Wroxham, near to Houghton St. John, two friends and myself were swimming across the lake from the Bure side, that's the name of the river, to that opposite. And strangely enough, we felt our feet touch the bottom. Now, at this part, there's much water, as much as 12, and in other places, 14 feet. And we kept together. Presently, found ourselves standing in the middle of a large arena, with much seats, one above the other, all around us. The water was gone, and we were dressed as Roman officers. And what is more astonishing still, we were not surprised, neither were we incommoded by this piece of enchantment, but rather we were quite accustomed to it, so that we forgot that we'd been bathing. And the top of the amphitheatre was open to the sky. Many flags of divers colours floated in the wind from the top of the walls. And then another account from the Reverend Thomas Josiah Penston. And he wrote this nearly a century after the one that we just looked at. And this is from 1709, and he wrote it for the Gentleman's Gazette. And he says, had exactly the same experience. We were holding a picnic on the banks of the beautiful lake in Norfolk, 11 miles from Norwich. Well, that is Wroxham Broad that he's describing. And we were somewhat angered by an unpleasant person who came and told us that he was the Custos Rotulorum. That was an important rank in the Roman army at that time, very important government post, keeper of the rolls. And then, suddenly, we saw this same hideous-looking man now dressed as a Roman general. And there were 10 prancing stallions drawing his chariot, a dozen lions led in chains by stalwart Roman soldiers, a band of trumpeters, and another band of drummers, followed by several hundred long-haired, partly armored seafaring men, all chained together. And the noise of their passing was very loud and unmistakable. And yet another witness in 1825 was a nobleman aboard his yacht, the Amaryllis. And he and the party who were on board the yacht also saw these very strange things going past. So it does look as if, for a period of several centuries, reliable witnesses have had time slips when they visited Wroxham Broad, either picnicking on the bank, sailing on it in a yacht, or swimming across it. And unless we can accept the possibility that there are time quakes, rather like earthquakes, that there are glitches and slips and abnormalities in time, I can't explain those eyewitness accounts.
Have you ever heard of some of the incredible accounts here at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania?
No, I'd love to hear about them.
Oh, my gosh. Civil War deaths occurred there, of course, by the thousands. And I get reports from people, Lionel, of visitors who've been to that area, and they will see in the night mist marching Civil War soldiers who are oblivious to them, but they just keep marching on. It's really something.
Now, this again is reflected in a number of other very reliable accounts of phantom armies, and there are so many here in the UK which are just like your Gettysburg experiences and accounts, in which again, what is interesting, and I think ties in with the theory of the power of emotion making these things visible again after so many years, in that when there is a civil war and you metaphorically have brother fighting brother, mm-hmm. in the war during the time of King Charles I, with Oliver Cromwell's parliamentarians fighting against the Cavaliers who were with King Charles, those armies were seen, and Ghost armies were seen long after the battles had been fought.
When we come back, Lina, let's talk more about poltergeists on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Lionel was showing some footage of a tomb in southern France. We're going to talk with him about that along with some ghost stories in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Lionel, tell me about this footage of a tomb in southern France.
Well, this is amazing because Patricia and I began investigating the mystery of Rennes Le Chateau and Beringer Saunier, the priest there who became immensely rich. And it was in that area. And one of the many theories that grew from the Rennes Le Chateau mystery of Beringer Saunier, the mysterious priest who made so much money inexplicably, one of the many theories was that Jesus had married Mary Magdalene, and that Mary Magdalene, accompanied by his uncle, Joseph of Arimathea, had come to the south of France after the crucifixion, and that Mary Magdalene had spent her last years in the south of France, but that she had had children by Jesus from her marriage to him, and that those children had grown up and had become part, eventually, of the old Merovingian French royal family. Now, that's just a very brief outline to explain these tombs. 1244 Films in Hollywood asked me to take part for them in a film that's almost ready for release, and which is called Bloodline. And it deals with that Mary Magdalene and the descendants of Jesus theory centered on Rennes Le Chateau, which isn't far from Carcassonne, on the foothills of the Pyrenees in southern France. Now, the other, another participant in this Bloodline film, which is a very serious and thrilling investigation of the theories of Rennes Le Chateau, had actually entered a tomb. One, despite our many visits to explore Rennes Le Chateau, we hadn't found, and I just wish we had, because I would certainly have done what he did. And very brave guy. He took his camera in with him and went in to investigate. And the problem is, it's a very narrow opening. And when you're in those limestone cave tombs in the Rennes area, like caving anywhere else, you have to be particularly careful that there isn't a rock fall behind you so that you join whoever is in that tomb unless the rescuers can get to you in good time. And in the exploration, he discovered two coffins. And it was so mysterious, and I said, so incredibly exciting, that of course there's always the possibility that it could have been Mary herself and one of their children. And I said, I can't wait for the film to be released, because I just think, you know, when we were talking earlier about the Salem witchcraft, the loss of reason in that, the possibility here of this other theory that Jesus and Mary had married and that Mary had had children, this is the reason for the title of Bloodline and where that follows through. And what may be in this tomb and what may be revealed if the DNA, for example, could still be extracted from whoever lies in that ancient tomb. I think this could turn out to be one of the mysteries of the century, either solved or one more candle has been brought into the dark area where the mystery is. And I said it was a great privilege and a pleasure for me to take part as one of the, and they paid me the honor of saying that I was regarded as one of the world experts on Rennes Le Chateau, because Patricia and I have written a number of books about it, we've written about it, and we've been investigating it pretty well firsthand for over 30 years. And it's like Doctor Who's TARDIS, you know, in the mystery time travel series. When you get into the mystery of Rennes Le Chateau, it's a lot bigger on the inside than it looked from the outside.
It's like a tent, one of those Arabian tents, huh?
Yeah.
Where on the outside is real small, and you go in and it goes on and on and on.
Yeah, it's like that, and the you find that you think the simple explanation is that a priest in 1885 discovered a mysterious treasure of some sort, but then when you start looking into all the mysteries that go with it, the strange organization called the Priory of Zion, who may or may not have been responsible for making Saunier rich in return for some service that he rendered them, well, it's the question mark goes up to the sky and disappears among the clouds.
Yeah, it sure does, doesn't it? Tell me, who do you think? What's your guess on who might be in those coffins?
Well, there is a very, very real possibility that it could be Mary Magdalene. Now, you see, I am not, although I'm a basically Orthodox Christian priest, I am not in the least shocked or horrified or aghast at the thought that Jesus could have been married and could have been a father, because if
and that
say,
could have been done before the crucifixion, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. Yes, very much. That, you see, you know the famous Leonardo da Vinci painting of the Last Supper, as in the Dan Brown Da Vinci Code, where you have the disciple next to Jesus in that painting, looking very, very feminine. And there are all the mysterious references in John's Gospel to the disciple whom Jesus loved. And maybe this was Mary Magdalene, who was the a member of the inner group of disciples, and who was, in fact, loved in the full sense of being his wife. And it would not be beyond the bounds of possibility that if, as his enemies knew, he was married and had children, they would have seen Jesus not as the divine savior, but as a rival to the Roman power, the Roman occupying power, and to the power of King Herod, the Roman puppet king. And it would have been very much in their interests politically, cynically politically, to get rid of Mary and of any children. Therefore, Joseph of Arimathea, who appears to have been, from what tradition tells us, a wealthy man and an uncle perhaps or a cousin of Jesus, he wants to get Mary and the children to safety, and he takes them to France.
And he could afford to.
And he could afford to. And again, if he is a rich merchant, there doesn't seem to be any reason why he couldn't have had ships available to get her safely there with a loyal captain whom he'd used before. You know the famous, and did those feat in ancient times, where there was a legend that Jesus, as a young boy, had come to England trading for tin in Cornwall with Uncle Joseph, or one of Uncle Joseph's trusted officers. It's a lovely sort of religious semi-legend, semi-myth,
right?
Because they wanted to establish, or they imagine the early church setting up in England when the missionaries first come over, if they could establish a link between Joseph of Arimathea, a wealthy merchant coming to Cornwall in England to buy tin, which was a very important and expensive commodity in the first century, and that he took his young nephew with him on this voyage, so that the early English church, especially the old Celtic church over in the West, could have said, ah, yes, Jesus himself once set foot in England as a small boy when his uncle took him for an adventure holiday. So if this is the same Joseph of Arimathea, who was totally sympathetic to Jesus and the cause, he would have done everything possible to protect Mary and any descendants.
If you want more information on this discovery in this movie, it's BloodlineTheMovie.com. BloodlineTheMovie.com.
And I really can recommend it.
What is your best poltergeist story, Lionel?
Well, I think that, excuse me, probably the very best poltergeist case, or the most interesting poltergeist case, concerns a girl called Esther Cox, and she was in Amherst in Nova Scotia. And it was on September the 4th, 1878. She leapt out of bed screaming that there was a mouse in the mattress. Now, it sounds almost like a trivial and humorous beginning for what turned into one of the most sinister and spectacular poltergeist cases that I've ever come across. Esther, who was 19, was sharing the bedroom with her elder sister, Jenny, who was just over 20, and the two girls lived as paying guests with their married sister because times were hard, and it was very useful if you could have family members as paying guests in your house to keep up the rent. And the house was full, and so there was plenty of witnesses when all this happened. Now, they failed to find the mouse that she thought was in the mattress. But a couple of days later, there were another strange adventure. Something moved again, so Esther and Jenny went to look for it, and they found a cardboard box under the bed that seemed to be moving. So, right, we've got the mouse. They opened the box. There is no mouse. And then the box continued to move. The events got more and more dramatic and traumatic. There were lights, there were lighted matches falling around the place. Esther was then taken ill, and her body swelled up, and she was crying with pain. And they sent for the family physician, who was Dr. Carrot. He had no idea what was wrong with her, but on September the 11th, as the chronicle goes, Esther was in bed, Dr. Carrot was watching, and the pillow slid out sideways from under her head, and it then slid in again of its own accord, rather like a drawer being pulled out of a chest of drawers. There were explosive sounds all over the room, and Dr. Carrot ran because whatever it was in there seemed to be pursuing him. And eventually, these poltergeist small fires started everywhere, from the cellar up to the attic, and only constant vigilance and very quick action prevented a major disaster and the house being burnt down. There was a very nice guy called John White, who was a staunch friend of the family, and he had a busy sort of tavern restaurant there in Amherst, and he said, look, Esther, you come and stay with us for a while. Maybe whatever it is in your house is limited to the house. And so Esther very happily took up John's invitation, and a knife flies through the air and sticks in her back. They managed to get it out and get the doctor to see to the wounds. And the next thing that happened was that in the kitchen of the restaurant, there was a big old iron cooking range with an oven that was fastened with an iron handle that you rotated, like the old-fashioned castle door.
Right, and it must have weighed a million pounds.
Huh? Yeah, really heavy, really solid thing. It came off the oven door, flew through the air, past Esther, and crashed into the public part of the restaurant where John was serving customers. And he went back, what's happening? And she said, I was sitting here, I did nothing. And he put it back, and he wedged it with a baseball bat so that it would be impossible to move. He goes back to the restaurant, and within a minute or so, the baseball bat has been pushed aside, and the big iron door fastener is once again sailing through the restaurant. John thinks, and he was a man of great presence of mind, I'm going to get an extra witness in, never mind me and the customers. And walking down the street at that moment was a government official who was a shipping inspector known to John, and he said, please, will you come and look at this? They put the iron handle back onto the big cooking range, and in the presence of the shipping inspector, government officer, it came off all on its own and flew across the tavern. Now, we very, very rarely get evidence of poltergeist cases which is so well authenticated by really top-class witnesses. And eventually Esther moved away and married, and the whole thing quietly died away, and she lived in Brockton, Massachusetts, until her death in 1912 at the age of 52.
That's a great story.
It's an amazing, and because it's so well authenticated, you know, so many witnesses and such phenomenal, such phenomenal happenings. When you say this thing weighed a ton and something pulled it off as if it was a feather. The poltergeist case that I investigated was much less spectacular than that, but I was called in by a family whose sons I was teaching, and they, knowing of my interest in the paranormal, said, "We're getting very strange things in this house that the kids aren't playing up, but it's almost like mischief. Shoes are turning up in the fridge, and items from the refrigerator, foodstuffs, cheese, butter, whatever, is turning up in the wardrobe. And underneath one of the carpets, there was some strange writing on the floorboards, when it just didn't seem possible that anybody could have lifted that carpet, made the inscription, and put the carpet back again." That again ties in with the Esther Cox story in Nova Scotia in Amherst, because at one point the witnesses heard a scratching sound as if somebody had an iron stylus and was writing on the wall of the room. They couldn't see either a hand or the stylus, but the words, "Esther Cox, you are mine to kill," appeared on the wall of her bedroom. Now, the words under the carpet were not threatening in any way. They were just casual. But what the thing was showing was that it had the ability to transmit messages. Now, the end of the story was that we called in Professor Santana, who's regarded as one of the world authorities on poltergeist phenomena. He called in another colleague who's a medium. And the story that was pieced together via the medium was that a 12-year-old girl had died in that house round about 1900, and that when this very happy family had taken the house over, they'd made some minor alterations, and it looked as if the making of the alterations, up in the attic particularly, had started the poltergeist phenomena. And according to the medium, the spirit of this little dead 12-year-old had said, "I want to be noticed. I want to be one of the family. I want to play with them as if they're my brothers and sisters." A very strange, unusual case. After that revelation to the medium, the phenomena slowly died away, as if she'd gone on to be happy in the real future world.
Have you heard some of the cases here in this country of someone seen a little girl in a white dress walking along the side of the road late at night? And obviously the person says, you know, something could happen to this child. He stops, picks her up, and they start driving. She doesn't say much, and he's feeling very eerie about all of this, and he's trying to say, you know, where I'm going to take you. So he figures, I'm going to take her to a police department. As he drives, Lionel, he comes to a stop, and she jumps out, and she goes running into a cemetery, and he goes to follow her and sees part of the white dress by the headstone of a little girl who died.
This is a version of an extremely well-known and widespread phenomena. I traced this all the way back because we have very parallel stories over here. And I traced this one back. It had an American origin, and in the variety of the versions, the motorist picks up either a very young girl, a child, and the cemetery version, finding the white dress on the headstone. There's also a version in which she is a young woman of 19 or 20, wearing evening clothes, party clothes, and standing looking very unhappy by the side of the road. And she actually speaks to him and says, "Please, can you take me home?" And he does. But when he gets there,
It's the cemetery, isn't it?
Yeah, there's. It's a very strange one. And in another version, he actually lends her his coat because it's raining. And the next day, he finds it on the tombstone.
Oh, my gosh. Stay with us. When we come back, we'll take phone calls, time travel stories, and we've got to hear the Spring Heel Jack story.